Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. So, Dr. Collins, you've alluded to some of these advances and some of these accomplishments that NIH research has achieved. I'd like to sort of highlight a little bit around chronic diseases, a healthy mind, infectious diseases, and maybe something around children's health and aging. What are some of the advances you see?
Well, let me pick a few specific examples. Chronic disease, I mentioned the epidemic of obesity and diabetes. What are we doing about that? There are some 60 million individuals who currently have what you call pre-diabetes who live in the United States. That is to say, they haven't been diagnosed with full-blown diabetes, but if you test their ability to handle sugar, glucose, they're clearly abnormal. And if nothing is done, the chances are that the majority of those individuals over time will tip over into full-blown diabetes with all of its complications. So you'd like to catch this at the pre-diabetes state and do something about it. Well, we now know how to do something about this based on NIH research. If those individuals are given an opportunity to get involved in a program of diet and exercise involving a coach, and that turns out to be crucial. You don't just send people away with a pamphlet. You actually put them in a position where they have encouragement, direct interaction with an expert who helps them figure out how to get into an exercise program, stick with it, and how to modify their diet just to lose 6 or 7% of their body weight. It's not like this enormously crash diet program. It turns out that will reduce that person's likelihood of going on to full-blown diabetes by 50 to 60%, and that's sustained over 10 years. So if we can implement this, which we're now trying to do in a collaborative effort with the CDC and the YMCA across the country, we could enormously reduce what is currently an epidemic of adult-onset diabetes, saving people all of those complications and saving our nation the costs of taking care of a diabetics, which is obviously an enormous part of our current escalation in medical costs. That's just an example. Other things, infectious diseases. Well, this is the year where the International AIDS Conference was held in Washington, D.C., and enormous achievements there in terms of taking what had been a fairly rapidly fatal disease in the 1980s to now turning this into a chronic illness managed by antiretroviral therapies so that somebody diagnosed as HIV positive now has a life expectancy of about age 70, which is just phenomenal to be able to say. And significant advances now in terms of the vaccines, which have been so frustrating to try to generate, but which are finally showing some promise, as well as other interventions that make us optimistic that we might, for the first time, be facing the possibility of an AIDS-free generation in the not-distant future. In children's health, well, certainly the efforts to understand the causes of autism come to mind, and we are learning a lot about that disease, although we need more information about how to intervene when that is diagnosed. The National Children's Study, which is going to get underway in the fairly near future, will follow 100,000 children all the way through pregnancy, delivery, and through their first 21 years of life. And that's going to teach us a lot about factors we don't know about yet. In terms of aging, the ability now to understand Alzheimer's disease at a much more detailed molecular level is giving us hopes that there will, in fact, be interventions for this disease that work, but probably there'll need to be interventions introduced as early as possible, not waiting until people already have far advanced symptoms. Just the same, I would say the whole field of Alzheimer's disease is energized in a way that has not happened in decades by the science that's happened, much of it just in the last few months.
Well, Dr. Collins, I'd like to switch gears a bit and talk about how technology in some sense is advancing or driving science. I think you can just look at the cost of the DNA sequencing to see this dynamic at work. The cost curve for sequencing has dropped precipitously, and I'd like to discuss that. What are the implications of a lower sequencing cost, and to what extent may it revolutionize how clinicians diagnose and treat diseases?
If you want to pick an area of technology that just takes your breath away in terms of the speed of its progress, it would be DNA sequencing. That first human genome sequence that I had the privilege of overseeing the team that managed to pull this off cost about $400 million when it was completed in 2003. You can now get your human genome sequenced for about $7,000. Think about that, 400 million down to 7,000 in the space of just about 9 years, and the cost continues to plummet. So we will, in the next 3 to 4 years, certainly achieve this goal that many people thought was a bit overly audacious, namely the $1,000 genome, but we're well on the way to achieving that. How will that change things? Well, it already is changing things in cancer, increasingly as part of research studies, and it won't be long before this finds its way into the management of cancer in general, is the desire to know in any given individual's cancer exactly what has gone wrong in those cancer cells that's causing them to grow faster than they're supposed to. Because cancer is a disease of the genome. And now we have the chance to look comprehensively, each individual at a time, in what's gone wrong there and what you might want to do about it. Because knowing that, you can then choose the right combination of targeted therapies that are not one size fits all, but are designed for that person's specific molecular signature. That's just one example. Certainly, all of us in the next decade will probably have the chance to have our complete genome sequences placed into our medical record. That will give insights into what you might be at risk for in the future. It will give insights into, if you fall ill, what drug should be used for you and what dose, because individual differences can be predicted by a study of the DNA. So it is going to transform the way we approach many medical problems, but not overnight. There were some overly optimistic predictions that this was going to happen in the blink of an eye. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of research, a lot of driving the cost down to make those things come true.
There's also some privacy concerns around genetic testing, and I'd like to switch gears on that. What are your thoughts around privacy concerns, and what needs to be done to the genetic testing infrastructure so that privacy issues are no longer a problem?
As the director of the Human Genome Project, one of my areas of focus was, in fact, on the ethical, legal, and social implications of these advances, and much work was done to try to anticipate what we would need to do about privacy and confidentiality. One of the big achievements of that focus was the passage and signing into law of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, which now, as the law of the land in the United States, says that your DNA information cannot be used against you in health coverage or in employment. That was a big issue that was getting in the way of a lot of people's comfort level in terms of having information about their genomes determined, even though they might want the information for medical purposes. In terms of privacy, again, this fits pretty much into the whole question of privacy of the rest of your medical record. Are we going to have a system where DNA information as part of that medical record is protected in the same way as the rest of it? I think we're coming along reasonably well there. Of course, many people would say our whole ideas of privacy are gradually evolving. Certainly, people in the younger generation seem a lot less concerned about those issues, judging by ways in which they put very private information up on Facebook. I wouldn't advocate, however, that we take that as necessarily a guide to good behavior. I think the privacy issues are manageable, however.
Dr. Collins, much of the NIH research successes have created the opportunity for personalized medicine. What are some of the benefits of personalized medicine? And perhaps you could share with us some success stories in this area.
Sure. I'm thinking of a success story related to a pair of twins that I have learned about and met their parents. These twins born with what appeared to be a neurologic problem that defied clear explanation. At some point, they were called cerebral palsy. Then they were tried on various drug therapies for something that fit into the category of a dystonia condition. But gradually, these two, Noah and Alexis Beery, became more and more impaired. And particularly Alexis, the girl, these are fraternal twins, became more severely ill to the point where she was spending much time in the ER. I had some very close calls with near-death experiences, and her parents at wit's end finally sought out investigators, in this case at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas, to see if there was anything else that could be done. The investigators decided, well, let's really make this personalized. Let's sequence the genomes of these two twins and their parents and see if we could uncover a cause. And in this case, they hit a home run. They found mutations in a particular enzyme that's responsible for producing normal levels of a neurotransmitter, and it made it clear that these two twins could not produce that neurotransmitter. But it was possible with a simple dietary change to supply that to them. Alexis, the twin who was near death about 3 years ago, is now running varsity track on her high school team. Just an amazing turnaround and the kind of success story you love to hear about. I could tell you about a few others of this sort, like Nick, a kid in Wisconsin who was near death from an inflammatory bowel disease condition that rarely strikes kids as young as he was, whose genome revealed a glitch in a gene on his X chromosome that suggested he might benefit from a stem cell transplant, which would never have been considered for his disease. The transplant was done. Nick, I gather, had a pretty good first grade year, is now having summer camp experiences, eating whatever he wants and doing just fine. So these things begin to appear, and it's exciting to see more and more of them.
So continuing on this thread of technology driving science, mobile devices have the potential to become powerful medical tools. But you also note that cool technology is not necessarily synonymous with good science or sound health practices. Would you elaborate on mHealth technologies and the potential benefits and issues associated with them?
I'm very excited about these because cell phones are now so ubiquitous, and the opportunity to use those for prevention purposes or monitoring chronic disease is very compelling. I volunteered myself for a clinical trial where my iPhone was connected up with a gadget that would send my EKG in real time across the country to a cardiologist in Los Angeles, who could then tell when I was excited because my heart rate would go up. Fortunately, I didn't have any other scary rhythms to report. But this is pretty amazing to imagine for somebody who does have a significant cardiac problem, where we've previously had to deal with very clunky ways of doing ambulatory monitoring and now could do this continuously with real-time transmission of the results to the physician. Another very exciting application is for diabetes monitoring. I've seen a pilot example of a small chip that's embedded under the skin at the wrist that is capable of continuously monitoring blood glucose without having to stick your finger every few hours. And it transmits the results to a gadget, which you wear like a watch. That, in turn, transmits this continuous tracing of your glucose to your care provider. If you want to get really good management of diabetes and know exactly where you are, this is where you'd like to have the technology take you. But I think we have to be sure we're not just carried away by the gee whiz aspects of these new gadgets. You have to also do the research to show that in the real world, that results in a better outcome. Otherwise, we're just fooling ourselves. And that's where I think NIH has a really important role to play with so-called mHealth, is to be sure that as these exciting new technologies emerge, they get put to the test to make sure they really benefit people in terms of their overall health status.
I want to continue on this this thread of benefit, and in particular, NIH's research and how it benefits the global competitiveness of the country. Could you elaborate on that?
It's very clear, if people look closely at the economic data, that medical research has been a major driver of American success, particularly in the last 20 or 30 years. It's also clear that America's leadership in biomedical research, which was unquestioned in the 1980s, is now being challenged substantially by accomplishments in other countries. And we should celebrate what those other countries are doing and the investments they're making, whether it's China or India or Brazil or Europe or the UK, all of whom are making very substantial plays now to try to increase their success in this regard. But if we're serious about having our own economy flourish, medical research is probably one of the best things to put a bet on, just judging by the way in which historically that has led America to be on top. And we have not really lived up to that promise for the last 10 years or so. The budget of the National Institutes of Health has been relatively flat since 2003. And if you look at what inflation has done to our buying power, we are actually down about 20% in terms of our support for medical research compared to 10 years ago. Whereas other countries like China, increasing its support for scientific research next year by 25% in 1 year. Meanwhile, we are not keeping up with the costs of doing this work. If you look at how that plays out in terms of economic growth, job creation, and so on, it is pretty clear that if we want to see our way out of the current difficulties, a dollar spent on medical research is a pretty wise investment.
That's terrific. So, Doctor, just really quickly, what are you doing at NIH to promote the highest level of scientific integrity and accountability in the conduct of science? But more importantly, how are you working to attract the next generation of doctors and scientists?
Very important questions. Certainly, we must conduct everything we do at NIH with the highest levels of integrity. We have to maintain that public trust. If we have lost that, then we've lost everything. We have very strict conflict of interest guidelines that are now applied to our scientists, both those who work in our intramural program and our grantees out there in universities, to be sure that their work is not in any way tainted by financial conflicts. If they have collaborations, for instance, with the private sector, that's fine, but that needs to be disclosed. It needs to be clear what the financial arrangements are so that no one will question whether the conclusions drawn by a scientist have been in some way influenced by something other than the facts. I think our house is very much in order in that regard. I think that's critical for public accountability. And our own sense of social responsibility has to apply to the fact that we're here to serve the public. Most scientists who work in academia or who work here at NIH are not particularly well compensated. They wouldn't go into this particular line of work if they were interested in getting rich. They're driven by a desire to make discoveries that are going to help people. That's our social responsibility. It's shared by everybody in the organization. It's one of the reasons it's such a great place to work. And I think that ethic is very much the way that we attract the next generation. Young scientists who want to make a difference, who believe in the power of science to make discoveries, and who have a mission in their own minds of wanting to make the world a better place. This is a great place to come and live out that dream. It's happening every day.
What does the future hold for the National Institutes of Health? We will ask Dr. Francis Collins, its director, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.